which was promptly published throughout the colonies, Franklin urged a continued boycott of all British manufactured goods. America, he argued, must be steady and persevere in our resolutions. Franklin had finally caught up with the more ardent patriotism spreading through the colonies, most notably Massachusetts. Writing to Samuel Cooper, a Boston minister, he declared that Parliament had no authority to tax the colonies or order British troops there. In truth, they have no such right, and their claim is founded only on usurpation. Still, like many Americans, he was not yet willing to advocate a total break with Britain. The solution, he felt, was a new arrangement, in which the colonial assemblies would remain loyal to the king, but no longer be subservient to Britain's Parliament. As he told Cooper, "Let us therefore hold fast our loyalty to our king, who has the best disposition toward us and has a family interest in our prosperity, as that steady loyalty is the most probable means of securing us from the arbitrary power of a corrupt Parliament that does not like us, and conceives itself to have an interest in keeping us down and fleecing us." It was an elegant formula for Commonwealth governance. Alas, it was based on the unproven assumption that the king would be more sympathetic to colonial rights than was Parliament. Franklin's letter to Cooper, widely published, helped to secure him an appointment by the Massachusetts lower house to be its agent in London as well. In January 1771, he paid a call on Lord Hillsborough to present those new credentials. Although the minister was dressing for court, he cheerfully had Franklin admitted to his chambers. But when Franklin mentioned his new appointment, Hillsborough sneered, "I must set you right there, Mr. Franklin. You are not agent."
"I do not understand, your lordship," replied Franklin. "I have the appointment in my pocket."
Hillsborough maintained that Massachusetts Governor Hutchinson had vetoed the bill appointing Franklin.
"There was no such bill," said Franklin. "It is a vote of the House."
"The House of Representatives has no right to appoint an agent," Hillsborough angrily retorted. "We shall take no notice of agents but such as are appointed by acts of assembly to which the governor gives his assent."
Hillsborough's argument was clearly specious. Franklin had, of course, been appointed as the agent of the Pennsylvania Assembly without the consent of the Penn family's governors there. The minister was trying to eliminate the right of the people to choose their own agents in London, and Franklin was appalled.
"I cannot conceive, my lord, why the consent of the governor should be thought necessary to the appointment of an agent for the people."
The discussion went downhill from there. Hillsborough, turning pale, launched into a tirade about how his firmness was necessary to bring order to the rebellious colonials, to which Franklin added a personal insult.
"It is, I believe, of no great importance whether the appointment is acknowledged or not, for I have not the least conception that an agent at present can be of any use to any of the colonies. I shall therefore give your lordship no farther trouble."
At that point, Franklin abruptly departed and went home to write down a transcript of the discussion.
"Hillsborough took great offense at some of my last words, which he calls extremely rude and abusive," Franklin reported to Samuel Cooper in Boston. "I find that he did not mistake me."
Initially, Franklin pretended to be unconcerned about Hillsborough's enmity.
"He is not a whit better liked by his colleagues in the ministry than he is by me," Franklin claimed in his letter to Cooper.
In another letter, he described Hillsborough as proud, supercilious, extremely conceited of his political knowledge and abilities, such as they are, fond of every one that can stoop to flatter him, and inimical to all that dare tell him disagreeable truths. The only reason he remained in power, Franklin surmised, was that the other ministers had difficulty of knowing how to dispose of or what to do with a man of his wrong-headed, bustling energy. Nevertheless, it soon became clear that the showdown with Hillsborough depressed Franklin. His friend Strawn noticed that he had become very reserved, which adds greatly to his natural inactivity, and there is no getting him to take part in anything. It also made him far more pessimistic about the eventual outcome of America's growing tensions with Britain. One could see in Parliament's actions the seeds sown of a total disunion of the two countries, he reported to the Massachusetts Committee on Correspondence, which brought out the more radical side of him. The bloody struggle will end in absolute slavery to America or ruin to Britain by the loss of her colonies. Despite such pessimistic feelings, Franklin still hoped for a reconciliation. He urged the Massachusetts Assembly to avoid passing an open denial and resistance to Parliament's authority, and instead adopt a strategy designed gradually to wear off the assumed authority of Parliament over America. He even went so far as to advise Cooper that it might be prudent in us to indulge the mother country in this concern for her own honor. And he continued to urge a policy of loyalty to the crown, if not to Parliament. This led some of his enemies to accuse him of being too conciliatory. "The doctor is not the dupe, but the instrument of Lord Hillsborough's treachery," the ambitious Virginian Arthur Lee wrote to his friend Samuel Adams. Lee went on to accuse Franklin of wanting to cling to his postmastership and keep his son in office. "All of this explained," he said, "the temporizing conduct he has always held in American affairs." Lee had his own motives. He wanted Franklin's job as agent in London. But Franklin still had the support of most Massachusetts patriots, including, at least for the time being, Samuel Adams. Adams ignored Lee's letter, allowed it to leak, and Franklin's friends in Boston, including Thomas Cushing and Samuel Cooper, assured him of their support. "Lee's attack," Cooper wrote, "served to confirm the opinion of your importance, while it shows the baseness of its author." But it also highlighted the difficulty that Franklin faced in attempting, as he had during the Stamp Act crisis, to be both a loyal Briton and an American patriot. Chapter 11. Rebel. London, 1771 through 1775. The Vacations of 1771. As the summer of 1771 approached, Franklin decided to forsake the world of public affairs for the time being. He had been stymied, at least for the moment, in all of his political missions. The fight against the proprietors and then Parliament, his pursuit of a land grant and a royal appointment. But he was still not ready to return home. So, instead, he escaped the pressures of politics in the manner he loved best, by taking an extended series of trips that lasted until the end of the year. To England's industrial Midland and North in May, to a friend's estate in southern England in June and again in August, and then to Ireland and Scotland in the fall. On his rambles in May, Franklin visited the village of Clapham, where there was a large pond. It was a windy day, and the water was rough, so he decided to test his theories about the calming effect of oil. Using just a teaspoon, he watched in amazement as it produced an instant calm that extended gradually to make a quarter of the pond, perhaps half an acre, as smooth as a looking-glass. Although Franklin would continue to study the effect of oil on water seriously, he also found ways to have fun by turning it into a conjuring trick. After this, I contrived to take with me, whenever I went into the country, a little oil in the upper hollow joint of my bamboo cane, he wrote. On a visit to the house of Lord Shelburne, he was walking by a stream with a group of friends, including the great actor David Garrick and the visiting French philosopher, the Abbé Morlaix, and told them he could still the waves. He walked upstream, waved his cane three times, and the surface of the stream calmed. Only later did he show off his cane and explain the magic. His tour of Midland and North England in the company of two fellow scientists gave Franklin the chance to study the Industrial Revolution that was booming there. He visited an iron and tin factory in Rotherham, the metal casting shops of Birmingham, and a silk mill in Derby, where 63,700 reels were turning constantly, and the twist process is tended by children of about 5 to 7 years old. In Manchester, he embarked in a luxurious horse-drawn boat, owned by the Duke of Bridgewater, that, befitting the peer's name, took him onto an aqueduct that crossed a river before ending in a coal mine. Near Leeds, they called on the scientist Joseph Priestley, who made some very pretty electrical experiments for them, and then described the various gases he had been discovering. Franklin had denounced England's mercantile trading laws, which were designed to suppress manufacturing in her colonies, by arguing, a bit disingenuously, that she would never have to fear that America would become an industrial competitor. In his letters from his tour in 1771, however, he sent detailed advice about creating silk, clothing, and metal industries that would make the colonies self-sufficient. He had become more and more convinced, he wrote his Massachusetts friend Thomas Cushing, of the impossibility that England would be able to keep up with America's growing demand for clothing. Necessity, therefore, as well as prudence, will soon induce us to seek resources in our own industry. Franklin returned to London briefly in early June, in time to be at court for the king's birthday, he wrote Deborah. Despite his disagreements with Parliament's taxation policies, he was still a loyal supporter of George III. "While we are declining the usurped authority of Parliament," he wrote Cushing that week, "I wish to see a steady, dutiful attachment to the king and his family maintained among us." After a fortnight in London, Franklin headed to the south of England, where he visited his friend Jonathan Shipley at his Tudor Manor in Twyford, just outside Winchester. Shipley was an Anglican bishop in Wales, but he spent most of his time in Twyford with his wife and five spirited daughters. It was such a delightful visit. Franklin might well have defined delight as an intellectually stimulating country house filled with five spirited young women, that he lamented that he had to leave after a week to attend to the correspondence that had been piling up in London. In his thank-you note to the Shipleys, which included a present of dried apples from America, Franklin complained that he had to breathe with reluctance the smoke of London, and said he hoped to get back to the sweet air of Twyford for a longer visit later that summer. The Autobiography. Franklin, at 65, had begun to think about family matters more. He felt affection for all of his kin, despite the fact, or perhaps as he himself speculated because of the fact, that he continued to live far away from them. In a long letter to his sole surviving sibling, Jane Meekham, that summer, he praised her for getting along well with her Philadelphia in-laws, and in a telling passage reflected on how much easier it was for relatives to remain friendly from afar. "Our father, who was a very wise man, used to say nothing was more common than for those who loved one another at a distance to find many causes of dislike when they came together." A good example, he noted, was the relationship their father had with his brother Benjamin. "Though I was a child, I still remember how affectionate their correspondence was while Benjamin remained in England. But when Uncle Benjamin moved to Boston, they began to engage in disputes and misunderstandings." Franklin also wrote Jane about Sally Franklin, a 16-year-old who had joined his surrogate family on Craven Street. Sally was the only child of a second cousin who had continued the Franklin family's textile dyeing business in Leicestershire. Accompanying the letter was a detailed family tree showing how they were all descendants of Thomas Franklin of Ecton, and noting that Sally was the last in England to bear the family name. His interest in family was further piqued when he happened to visit one of his favorite used bookshops in London. The dealer showed him a collection of old political pamphlets that were filled with annotations. Franklin was amazed to discover that they had belonged to his uncle Benjamin. "I suppose he parted with them when he left England," Franklin wrote in a letter to another cousin. "He promptly bought them." So, in late July, when he was finally free to return to Twyford for a longer stay with the Shipleys, he was in a reflective mood. His career was at an impasse, and the history of his family was on his mind. Thus, the stage was set for the first installment of the most enduring of his literary efforts, The Autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. "Dear son," he began, casting his account as a letter to William, whom he had not seen for 7 years. The epistolary guise gave him the opportunity to be chatty and casual in his prose. He pretended, at least initially, that this was merely a personal communication rather than a work of literature. "I used to write more methodically," he said in a paragraph he inserted into the text after rereading some of the rambling genealogical digressions he had composed on the first day. "But one does not dress for private company as for a public ball." Was the autobiography really just for the private company of his son? No. It was clear from the outset that Franklin was writing for public consumption as well. The family information that would most interest his son was omitted completely, the identity and description of William's own mother. Nor did Franklin write the letter on regular stationery. Instead, he used the left half of large folio sheets, leaving the right half blank for revisions and additions. At the beginning of his second day of writing, he stopped to make an outline of his entire career, showing his intention to construct a full memoir. Also, that second morning, he used the blank right-hand columns of his first pages to insert a long section justifying the vanity of his decision to indulge the inclination so natural in old men to be talking of themselves. His goal, he declared, was to describe how he rose from obscurity to prominence and to provide some useful hints about how he succeeded, expressing hope that others might find them suitable to be imitated. This was obviously directed at an audience beyond that of his son, who was already 40 and the governor of New Jersey. There was, however, a subtext directed at him. William had taken on airs since becoming a governor, and he was far more enamored of the aristocracy and establishment than his father. The autobiography would be a reminder of their humble origins and a paean to hard work, thrift, shopkeeping values, and the role of an industrious middle class that resisted rather than emulated the pretensions of the well-born elite. For almost 3 weeks, Franklin wrote by day and then read aloud portions to the Shipleys in the evening. Because the work was cast as a letter, and because it was read aloud, Franklin's prose took on the voice of a lovable old raconteur. Lacking in literary flair, with nary a metaphor nor poetic flourish, the narrative flowed as a string of wry anecdotes and instructive lessons. Occasionally, when he found himself writing with too much pride about an event, he would revise it by adding a self-deprecating comment or ironic aside, just as would a good after-dinner storyteller. The result was one of Franklin's most delightful literary creations, the portrait he painted of his younger self. The novelist John Updike has memorably called it an elastically insouciant work, full of cheerful contradictions and humorous twists, a fond look back upon an earlier self, giving an intensely ambitious young man the benefit of the older man's relaxation. With a mix of wry detachment and amused self-awareness, Franklin was able to keep his creation at a bit of a distance, to be modestly revealing, but never deeply so. Amid all the enlightening anecdotes, he included few intimations of inner torment, no struggles of the soul or reflections of the deeper spirit. More pregnant than profound, his recollections provide a cheerful look at a simple approach to life that only hints at the deeper meanings he found in serving his fellow man and thus his God. What he wrote had little pretension other than pretending to poke fun at all pretensions. It was the work of a gregarious man who loved to recount stories, turn them into down-home parables that could lead to a better life, and delve into the shallows of simple lessons. To some, this simplicity is its failing. The great literary critic Charles Angoff declares that it is lacking in almost everything necessary to a really great work of belles lettres: grace of expression, charm of personality, and intellectual flight. But surely it is unfair to say that it lacks charm of personality, and as the historian Henry Steele Commager points out, its artless simplicity, lucidity, homely idiom, freshness, and humor have commended it anew to each generation of readers. Indeed, read with an unjaundiced eye, it is a pure delight as well as an archetype of homespun American literature. And it was destined to become, through hundreds of editions published in almost every language, the world's most popular autobiography. In this age of instant memoirs, it is important to note that Franklin was producing something relatively new for his time. St. Augustine's Confessions had mainly been about his religious conversion, and Rousseau's Confessions had not yet been published. There had been almost no famous autobiographies before Franklin, and he had no models, writes Carl Van Doren. That is not entirely true. Among those who had already published some form of autobiography were Benvenuto Cellini, Lord Herbert of Shrewsbury, and Bishop Gilbert Burnet. But Van Doren is correct when he says that Franklin wrote for a middle class which had few historians. His book was the first masterpiece of autobiography by a self-made man. The closest model that he had in terms of narrative style was one of his favorite books, John Bunyan's allegorical dream, A Pilgrim's Progress. But Franklin's was the story of a very real pilgrim, albeit a lapsed one, in a very real world. By the time he had to leave Twyford in mid-August, he had finished the first of four installments in what would later become known as the autobiography. It took him through his years as a young printer engaged in civic endeavors and ended with the founding of the Philadelphia Library and its offshoots in 1731. Only in his last lines did he let a note of politics creep in. "These libraries," he noted, "have made the common tradesmen and farmers as intelligent as most gentlemen from other countries, and perhaps have contributed in some degree to the stand so generally made throughout the colonies in defense of their privileges." It would be 13 years before, at the urging of friends, he would pick up that part of the tale. Always eager to create a family wherever he could find one, Franklin took the Shipleys' youngest daughter, Kitty, 11, under his wing, and brought her in his coach back to London, where she was going to school. Along the way, they chatted about the type of man each of the Shipley daughters would marry. Kitty felt all of her sisters deserved a very rich merchant or aristocrat. "As for herself," Kitty coquettishly allowed, "I like an old man, indeed I do, and somehow or another all the old men take to me." "Perhaps she should marry a younger man," Franklin suggested, "and let him grow old upon your hands, because you'll like him better and better every year as he grows older." Kitty replied that she would prefer to marry someone already older. "And then, you know, I may be a rich young widow." Another lifelong flirtation was born. He had his wife send over a squirrel from Philadelphia as a pet for all the Shipley girls. When the creature met an untimely end a year later in the jaws of a dog, Franklin composed a flowery epitaph, and then added a simpler one that would become famous. "Here Scug lies snug as a bug in a rug." His affection for Kitty would be immortalized 15 years later when Franklin, then 80, wrote for her a little essay on The Art of Procuring Pleasant Dreams. On his last evening at Twyford, the Shipleys had insisted on throwing a birthday party in absentia for his Philadelphia grandson, 2-year-old Benjamin Franklin Bache. "That he may be as good as his grandfather," Mrs. Shipley said in her toast. Franklin responded that he hoped that Benny would, in fact, turn out much better, to which Bishop Shipley added, "We will compound the matter and be contented if he should prove not quite so good." The odd thing about all this affection for Benny was that Franklin had never met him, nor showed much of an inclination to do so. He had not even met the boy's father. But at that moment, Richard Bache was arriving in England on a mission to find his famous father-in-law. Bache appeared unannounced on Craven Street, where Mrs. Stevenson joyously greeted him. Franklin, however, had already departed, after little more than a week in London, for another extended vacation. Ireland and Scotland. Traveling with Richard Jackson, Pennsylvania's other agent in England, Franklin left in late August 1771 for 3 months in Ireland and Scotland, hoping to see if the relationship those countries were trying to forge within the British Empire might serve as a model for America. there were some promising signs. When they visited the Irish Parliament, Jackson was accorded the right to sit in the chamber because he was a member of England's Parliament. On seeing the famous Franklin, the Speaker proposed that, because he represented American legislatures, he should be accorded such a privilege as well. "The whole House gave a loud, unanimous aye," Franklin reported to Cushing. "I esteemed it a mark of respect for our country." On the other hand, much of what he saw in Ireland distressed him. England severely regulated Irish trade, and absentee English landlords exploited Irish tenant farmers. They live in wretched hovels of mud and straw, are clothed in rags, and subsist chiefly on potatoes, he noted. His shock at the disparity between rich and poor made him all the more proud that America was building a vibrant middle class. "The strength of America," he wrote, "was its proud freeholders and tradesmen, who had the right to vote on public affairs and ample opportunity to feed and clothe their families." While in Dublin, Franklin happened to run into his nemesis, Lord Hillsborough, whose family estate was in Northern Ireland. Surprisingly, Hillsborough insisted that he and Jackson stop by on their way to Scotland. Franklin was conflicted. "As it might afford an opportunity of saying something on American affairs," he wrote one friend, "I concluded to comply with his invitation." But he subsequently wrote his son that he had determined not to go. As it turned out, Jackson insisted on going, and Franklin could not find another coach, so had to follow along. It was an astonishingly friendly visit. At Hillsborough's house, Franklin was detained by 1,000 civilities for almost a week. "The minister seemed attentive to everything that might make my stay in his house agreeable. That even included putting his own cloak about my shoulders when I went out, that I might not take cold." In discussing Ireland's poverty, Hillsborough blamed it on England for restraining manufacturing there. "Wasn't the same true," Franklin asked, "about England's policy toward America?" To Franklin's pleasure, Hillsborough responded that America ought not to be restrained in manufacturing. He even suggested a subsidy for American silk industries and winemaking. He would be pleased to hear Franklin's opinion and advice on that, as well as on how to form a government for Newfoundland. Would Franklin consider these issues, and when he returned to London, favor him with my sentiments? "Does not all this seem extraordinary to you?" he wrote his son. In a letter to Thomas Cushing, he suggested there might be a more cynical explanation. Hillsborough's behavior might be meant only by patting and stroking the horse to make him more patient when the reins are drawn tighter and the spurs set deeper into his sides. Or, perhaps, he apprehended an approaching storm, and was desirous of lessening beforehand the number of enemies he had so imprudently created. Franklin arrived through storms and floods in Edinburgh late on a Saturday, and spent one night lodged miserably at an inn. But that excellent Christian David Hume, agreeable to the precepts of the gospel, has received the stranger, and now I live with him, Franklin reported the next day. His old friend Hume had built a new house, and he took pride that the sheep's head soup made by his cook was the best in Europe. The talk at the table was also enviable. Philosophy, Hume had recently befriended Rousseau in Paris, history, and the plight of the American colonies. After 10 days, Franklin traveled west toward Glasgow to see Lord Kames, his other favorite Scottish philosopher. Kames was also a great botanist, who cultivated arbors of diverse trees. The ones Franklin planted on his visit are alive today. On his way back to Edinburgh, Franklin stopped at the Carron Ironworks, where James Watt was developing the steam engine, so that he could continue his study of industrialization. Among the ordnance they saw being cast, some of which would be used against the colonies in a few years, were cannons that weighed up to 32 tons. Back at Hume's house in Edinburgh, Franklin spent another few days enjoying the intellectual circle there. He met with Adam Smith, who reportedly showed him some early chapters of The Wealth of Nations that he was then writing. Perhaps suspecting that they would never see their American friend again, Hume hosted a farewell dinner that included a variety of Franklin's favorite Scottish academics and writers, including Lord Kames. Meeting Bache. Franklin had planned to stay longer with Hume, but two letters caught up with him while he was there. One was from his son-in-law, Richard Bache. Having missed Franklin in London, he wrote, he had gone to visit his own parents in Preston, a city in the north of England near Manchester. The other was from Polly. Mr. Bache is at Preston, where he will wait with the pleasing expectation of seeing you on your return. We were all very much pleased with him. So Franklin hastened his departure for London and decided to visit his new in-law on the way. Sally Franklin Bache, not surprisingly, was fretting back in Philadelphia about how her husband and father would get along. "If it should not be as cordial as I could wish," she wrote Richard, "I know when you consider it is my father, your goodness to and affection for me will make you try a little to gain his esteem and friendship." As it turned out, her fears were unfounded. "I can," Bache joyously wrote Deborah, "with great satisfaction, tell you that he received me with open arms, and with a degree of affection I did not expect. He was particularly pleased that everyone told him he looked like Franklin, a revelation in those pre-Freudian times that was not seen as a reflection of Sally's taste in a husband. I should be glad to be like him in any respect," Bache enthused. Indeed, the old charmer wowed everyone in Bache's family, particularly his mother, Mary Bache, a stately and serious widow of 68, who had borne 20 children. During the visit, she stayed up until midnight talking to Franklin. A few weeks later, Franklin sent her a thank-you note with some oysters and, his vanity not fully conquered, a portrait of himself. Mrs. Bache carried it back and forth from the parlor to the dining room so she could view it all the time. "It is so like the original you cannot imagine with what pleasure we look at it, as we can perceive in it the likeness of my son as well as yourself." Bache traveled back to London with Franklin, stayed with him for a while on Craven Street, and tried hard to please. "His behavior here has been agreeable to me," Franklin told Deborah. But his affection did not extend to offering Bache the help he sought in winning a public appointment, such as customs inspector. "I am of the opinion that almost any profession a man has been educated in is preferable to an office held subject to the caprices of superiors." Instead, he advised Bache to go home, become a merchant selling only for ready cash, and to always be close to his wife. This advice, it must be remembered, came from a man who had lived across an ocean from his wife for much of 15 years and had been clinging to his appointment as a royal postmaster. As for Sally, he advised that she should learn accounting, always a theme, and help her husband out. In keeping a store, if it be where you dwell, you can be serviceable to him as your mother was to me, for you are not deficient in that capacity, and I hope you are not too proud. The Baitches, ever mindful, would end up living in Deborah's house, opening a store in one of Franklin's Market Street buildings, and advertising, for cash only, a variety of silks and textiles for sale. When this dry goods shop turned out to be, as Bache complained to Franklin, a sorry concern, he converted it to a wine and grocery business, which also fared poorly. It was not the status or situation a woman of Sally's education and Bache's ambition felt was their due, but they followed Franklin's injunction to be not too proud. Deborah wrote Franklin so often about their grandson Benny that one can detect a note of caution creeping into his responses. "I can see you are quite in love with him, and your happiness wrapped up in his." He praised her for not stepping in during an argument when Sally was trying to discipline Benny. "I feared, from your fondness of him, that he would be too much humored and perhaps spoiled." He felt differently, however, about spoiling Polly Stevenson's new son, William Hewson, who had been born that spring. "Pray let him have everything he likes," he had written to Polly. "It gives children a pleasant air, and the face is ever after the handsomer for it." In the same letter he responded sanguinely to Polly's teasing news that her mother had a new male friend. "I have been used to rivals," replied Franklin, "and scarce ever had a friend or a mistress in my whole life that other people did not like as well as myself." Within 2 years, Billy Hewson had become Franklin's surrogate grandson. Responding to yet another letter from his wife describing their own grandson, Franklin wrote, "In return for your history of your grandson, I must give you a little of the history of my godson. He is now 21 months old, very strong and healthy, begins to speak a little and even to sing. He was with us a few days last week, grew fond of me, and would not be contented to sit down to breakfast without coming to call Pa." He did deign to add, however, that watching Billy makes me long to be at home to play with Ben. More science and invention. When he poured the teaspoon of oil on the pond in Clapham and noted that it spread for a half acre, Franklin had come close to a discovery that would not be made for another century, determining the size of a molecule. If he had taken the volume of the teaspoon of oil, 2 cubic centimeters, and divided it by the half-acre area it covered, 2,000 square meters, he would have arrived at a ballpark figure, 10 to the minus 7th power centimeters, for the thickness of an oil molecule. As Charles Tanford noted in his wonderful book, Ben Franklin Stilled the Waves, Franklin had actually correctly determined the scale of magnitude of molecular dimensions, the first person ever to do so, but he did not recognize it. Franklin was always better at practical applications than theoretical analysis. Rather than speculate about the size of molecules, he looked for uses for his oil and water experiments. Might it be possible to save ships from dangerous waves by dumping oil into the ocean? With 3 friends from the Royal Academy, he went to Portsmouth to see. "The experiment," Franklin reported, "had not the success we wished. The surface ripples were smoothed, but not the force of the underlying surges. Another metaphor, perhaps. His report on his failed experiment was deemed useful enough, however, to be published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. Throughout his time in England, whenever he could escape the demands of politics, he continued his scientific inquiries. After he wired some lightning rods on St. Paul's Cathedral, the keepers of the Royal Munitions asked him to propose ways to protect their buildings from lightning as well. This again embroiled Franklin in a dispute over whether lightning rods should have pointed or rounded tops. Franklin insisted on pointed ones, but, perhaps for political reasons, King George changed them to rounded ones after the American Revolution. Franklin also devised a system of hot water pipes to keep the House of Commons warm. Other excursions into science and invention during his years in London included the cause of colds. Although germs and viruses had yet to be discovered, Franklin was one of the first to argue that colds and flu may possibly be spread by contagion rather than cold air. Traveling in our severe winters, I have often suffered cold sometimes to the extremity only short of freezing, but this did not make me catch cold, he wrote the Philadelphia physician Benjamin Rush in 1773. People often catch cold from one another when shut up together in close rooms, coaches, etc., and when sitting near and conversing so as to breathe in each other's transpiration. The best defense was fresh air. Throughout his life, Franklin liked good ventilation and open windows, even in the midst of winter. The study of exercise. One way to prevent colds, he argued, was regular exercise. The best way to measure exercise, he argued, was not by its duration, but by the degree of warmth it produces in the body. This was one of the first theories linking exercise to calories of heat. For example, he explained, walking a mile up and down stairs produced 5 times more body warmth than walking a mile on a level surface. When swinging weights, Franklin calculated that this raised his pulse from 60 to 100 beats per minute. Again, he rightly calculated that body warmth generally increases with quickness of pulse. Lead poisoning. As a printer, Franklin had noticed that the handling of hot lead type often caused a stiffness or paralysis. He also noticed that people in certain trades were prone to a severe illness called dry bellyache. A friend added a clue by noting that people who drank rum from stills that used metal coils also got the disease. Acting as an epidemiologist, Franklin became one of the first to discover the cause of this malady. It affects, among tradesmen, those that use lead, however different their trades, as glaziers, type founders, plumbers, potters, white lead makers, and painters. He suggested, among other things, that the coils of stills should be made of pure tin, instead of pewter that includes lead. Ships in canals. When visiting Holland, Franklin and his friend Sir John Pringle, president of the Royal Society, were told that ships passing through shallow canals went more slowly than those in deeper canals. This was because, Franklin surmised, each time a boat moved one length of distance, it would have to displace an amount of water equal to the space that her hull took up under the water. That water would have to pass alongside or underneath the boat. If the passage underneath was constrained by being shallow, more water would have to rush past the sides of the boat, thus slowing her down. Here was a scientific theory that had enormous practical importance. So Franklin reacted accordingly. "I determined to make an experiment of this," he wrote Pringle. He built a 14-foot wooden trough that was 6 inches wide and deep, and in it he put a little boat that was tugged by a silk thread. The thread was placed over a pulley and pulled by the weight of a small coin. He repeatedly timed how fast the toy boat moved when the water was at various depths. The results showed that it took 20% more power or time to move a boat through a shallow canal than a deeper one. The saltiness of oceans. At the time, the prevailing opinion about why the oceans were salty was that they had originally been filled with fresh water. But over the eons they accumulated the salts and minerals that were dumped into them by rivers. Franklin surmised in a letter to his brother Peter that there was just as much evidence for the other hypothesis. All the water on this globe was originally salt, and the fresh water we find in springs and rivers is the produce of distillation. As it turns out, Franklin was incorrect in this case. The oceans over the centuries have been getting saltier. The harmonica. Among the most amusing of his inventions was a musical instrument he called the harmonica. It was based on the common practice of bored dinner guests and some musicians of producing a resonant tone by moving a wet finger around the rim of a glass. Franklin attended a concert in England of music performed on wine glasses, and in 1761 he perfected the idea by taking 37 glass bowls of different sizes and attaching them to a spindle. He rigged up a foot pedal and flywheel to spin the contraption, which allowed him to produce various tones by pressing on the glass pieces with his wet fingers. In a letter to an Italian electrician, Franklin described the new instrument in minute detail. "It is an instrument," he said, "that seems peculiarly adapted to Italian music, especially that of the soft and plaintive kind." Franklin's harmonica was quite a rage for a while. Marie Antoinette took lessons on it, Mozart and Beethoven wrote pieces for it, and its haunting tones became popular at weddings. But it tended to produce melancholia, perhaps from lead poisoning, and it eventually went out of fashion. Social philosophy. Over the years, Franklin had been developing a social outlook that, in its mixture of liberal, populist, and conservative ideas, would become one archetype of American middle-class philosophy. He exalted hard work, individual enterprise, frugality, and self-reliance. On the other hand, he also pushed for civic cooperation, social compassion, and voluntary community improvement schemes. He was equally distrustful of the elite and the rabble, of ceding power to a well-born establishment or to an unruly mob. With his shopkeeper's values, he cringed at class warfare. Bred into his bones was a belief in social mobility and the bootstrap values of rising through hard work. His innate conservatism about government intervention and welfare was evident in the series of questions he had posed to Peter Collinson in 1753. Back then, he had asked whether laws which compel the rich to maintain the poor have not given the latter a dependence and provide encouragements for laziness. To Collinson, these points were raised as questions. But in his essays in the late 1760s and early 1770s, Franklin asserted his conservatism more forcefully. Most notable was an anonymous piece entitled On the Laboring Poor, which he signed Medius, from the Latin word for middle, and published in the Gentleman's Magazine in 1768. In the essay, he chastised writers who stirred up the rabble by claiming that the poor were oppressed by the rich. "Will you admit a word or two on the other side of the question?" he asked. "The conditions of the poor in England was the best in Europe," he argued. "Why?" "Because in England there was legislation to help support the poor." "This law was not made by the poor. The legislators were men of fortune. They voluntarily subjected their own estates and the estates of others to a payment of a tax for the maintenance of the poor." These laws were compassionate, but he warned that they could have unintended consequences and promote laziness. "I fear the giving mankind a dependence on anything for support in age or sickness, besides industry and frugality during youth and health, tends to flatter our natural indolence, to encourage idleness and prodigality, and thereby to promote and increase poverty, the very evil it was intended to cure." Not only did he warn against welfare dependency, but he offered his own version of the trickle-down theory of economics. The more money made by the rich and by all of society, the more money that would make its way down to the poor. The rich do not work for one another. Everything that they or their families use and consume is the produce of the laboring poor. The rich spend their money in ways that enrich the laboring poor: clothing and furniture and dwellings. Our laboring poor receive annually the whole of the clear revenues of the nation. He also debunked the idea of imposing a higher minimum wage. A law might be made to raise their wages, but if our manufactures are too dear, they might not vend abroad. His economic conservatism was balanced, however, by his fundamental moral belief that actions should be judged by how much they benefit the common good. Policies that encouraged hard work were good, but not because they led to great accumulations of private wealth. They were good because they increased the total well-being of a community and the dignity of every aspiring individual. People who acquired more wealth than they needed had a duty to help others and to create civic institutions that promoted the success of others. His ideal was of a prosperous middle class whose members lived simple lives of democratic equality, writes James Campbell. Those who met with greater economic success in life were responsible to help those in genuine need. But those who, from lack of virtue, failed to pull their own weight could expect no help from society. To this philosophical mix, Franklin added an increasingly fervent advocacy of the traditional English liberal values of individual rights and liberties. He had not yet, however, completed his evolution on the great moral question of slavery. As an agent for some of the colonies, including Georgia, he found himself awkwardly and unconvincingly defending America against British attacks that slavery made a mockery of the colonists' demands for liberty. In 1770, he published anonymously A Conversation on Slavery, in which the American participant tries to defend himself against charges of hypocrisy. Only one family in 100 in America has slaves, and of those, many treat their slaves with great humanity. He also argued that the condition of the working poor in England seems something a little like slavery. At one point, the speaker's argument even lapses into racism. Perhaps you imagine the Negroes to be a mild-tempered, tractable kind of people. Some of them are indeed so. But the majority are of a plotting disposition, dark, sullen, malicious, revengeful, and cruel in the highest degree. In his desire to defend America at all costs, Franklin had produced what was one of the worst arguments he ever wrote. Even his facts were wrong. The proportion of slave-owning families in America was not 1 in 100, but close to 1 in 9. 47,664 families out of a total 410,636 American families owned slaves in 1790. Making his argument morally as well as factually weak was the fact that even as he tried to argue that slave-owning was an aberration, Franklin's own family was among those who still kept slaves. Although the two slaves who had accompanied him on his first trip to England were no longer with him, one or two continued to be part of Deborah's Philadelphia household. His views, however, were still evolving. 2 years after he wrote The Conversation, Franklin began corresponding with the ardent Philadelphia abolitionist Anthony Benezet. He used some of Benezet's arguments in a 1772 piece he wrote for the London Chronicle, in which he decried, using stronger language than ever, the constant butchery of the human species by this pestilent, detestable traffic in the bodies and souls of men. He even edged closer to Benezet's argument that slavery itself, not merely the importation of new slaves, had to be abolished. "I am glad to hear that the disposition against keeping Negroes grows more general in North America," he wrote Benezet. "I hope in time it will be taken into consideration and suppressed by the legislature." Franklin wrote in a similar vein to his friend, the Philadelphia physician Benjamin Rush, "I hope in time that the Friends to Liberty and Humanity will get the better of a practice that has so long disgraced our nation and religion." Yet it is important to note that both to Benezet and to Rush, Franklin included the same qualifying phrase, "in time." For Franklin, support for complete abolition of slave ownership, rather than merely ending the importation of slaves, would come only in time, only after the Revolution. Defeating Hillsborough. Lord Hillsborough's solicitous warmth in Ireland, which had so baffled Franklin, soon dissipated. "When I had been a little while returned to London," Franklin wrote his son, "I waited on him to thank him for his civilities in Ireland." The porter informed Franklin that the minister was not at home. Franklin left his card and returned another day to hear the same response, even though Franklin knew Hillsborough was indeed receiving guests that day. He tried the next week, then the next, to no avail. "The last time was on a levee day, when a number of carriages were at his door. My coachman, driving up, alighted and was opening the coach door when the porter, seeing me, came out and surlily chid the coachman for opening the door before he had inquired whether my lord was at home, and then, turning to me, said, 'My lord is not at home.' I have never since been nigh him, and we have only abused one another at a distance. Hillsborough threw me away as an orange that would yield no juice and therefore not worth more squeezing," Franklin complained. Again he considered returning to Philadelphia. "I grow homesick," he wrote William. But there was still one factor that kept him from leaving England in fury. Against all odds, he remained hopeful that he could secure for himself and friends, family, and partners, a western land grant along the Ohio. To that end, He had been involved with a variety of partnerships, including ones called the Illinois Company and then the Indiana Company, that had failed to win support in London. In the summer of 1769, Franklin helped organize a consortium so powerful that he was convinced it would be able to outmaneuver Lord Hillsborough. The Grand Ohio Company, as it was named, included a collection of some of London's richest and most prominent names, most notably Thomas and Richard Walpole. For a while, it seemed the group known as the Walpole Company was destined for success. But in the summer of 1770, Hillsborough managed to have the scheme tabled for more study. The Walpole Group, however, was able to keep its prospects alive by spreading around ownership shares to an array of top ministers, including the Lord Chancellor and the President of the Privy Council. By the spring of 1772, Hillsborough could delay the matter no longer. Even the king let Hillsborough know that he expected the matter to be considered. In April, the Board of Trade sent the land application to the Privy Council with a recommendation that it be denied. But the Privy Council, 2 months later, held its own hearing, attended by Franklin, Walpole, and many of their influential shareholders. Hillsborough threatened to resign if it was approved, a prospect that likely hurt his case because so many on the council were eager, in Franklin's words, to mortify him. And they did. The grant was approved, and Hillsborough resigned. Franklin and friends would never end up getting their land grant. The growing tensions between Britain and the colonies intervened. "The affair of the grant goes on but slowly," he wrote a friend the following year. "I begin to be a little of the sailor's mind. When they were handing a cable out of a store into a ship, and one of them said, 'Tis a long, heavy cable. I wish we could see the end of it.' 'Damn me,' says another, 'if I believe it has any end. Somebody has cut it off.'" Still, Franklin had succeeded in ousting his nemesis.